This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So the first question this month is from Peter, and he wrote in to say, I was thinking, as you do, what would happen when two black holes merged? When it occurred to me that as time slows exponentially as you near the singularity, will a second black hole singularity ever meet the original one? And for that matter, does anything drawn into a black hole ever reach the singularity? So there's a few things we probably ought to define, really, to remind ourselves of. First of all, what's a black hole? Well, it's just an object whose gravity is so strong that in order to escape from it, you'd actually have to travel faster than the speed of light. The escape velocity is greater than the speed of light. So you can get that by packing enough mass into a small enough volume. So if you took, say, the Earth or something, if you could sort of squash the Earth down to be a marble-sized thing a few centimetres across, then the force of gravity at its surface would become huge, so huge that you'd have to travel faster than the speed of light to escape, and so not even light can escape from it, and you will have made a black hole. So it turns out, to answer the last part of Peter's question first, does, for matter drawn into a black hole, does it ever reach the singularity? Well, what do we mean by that? What we mean is that if you imagine squashing this Earth right down to being smaller than the size of a marble, then there's a point as we sort of approach it, if we imagine getting closer and closer to it, there's a sort of surface in space surrounding it. We call it the event horizon, that as we pass through that point, that's the point at which the gravity gets so strong that we then can't escape. We'd have needed to travel faster than the speed of light to escape. So once you're inside the event horizon, you're stuck. You're inside the black hole, basically. And everything then does just collapse down. According to our current understanding of physics, at least, everything will collapse right down to this thing we call a singularity. It's a point of infinite density. And you're sort of doomed once you go within that event horizon. Now, that sort of assumes there is a singularity and there is a point of infinite density. To be honest, I'm not particularly comfortable with anything that's infinite, so that would seem a bit strange. And it may be that perhaps there's some exotic physics that we don't yet know about, perhaps quantum gravity or something, that would actually prevent the formation of an actual singularity, a point of infinite density. But we don't know that yet. Now, to return to the first part of Peter's question, he said about two black holes merging, and he mentioned time slowing down exponentially as you near the singularity, he says, actually. Well, in fact, what goes on is that time slows down as you approach the event horizon. Now, what we mean by that is, we should be careful, is that if you imagine a clock, or even your watch or something, if you fell towards a black hole, then that clock that's sort of carried with an object that passes in through the event horizon into the black hole, that clock just keeps ticking as normal. So from the point of view of the observer carried with the clock into the black hole, time isn't affected. But from the point of view of an external observer sitting away from the black hole, looking at this clock as it moves towards it, the gravitational effect is that you see the clock ticking slower and slower and slower. And actually, at the point that it reaches the event horizon, it stops. So it ticks more and more slowly until eventually it freezes at the event horizon. So that's from the point of view of an external observer. But the actual clock does pass through the event horizon, and if it were two black holes merging, once it could pass within each other's event horizon, and they could indeed meet and merge. Okay, the next question is from David, and David asks, if other civilizations across the universe, imaginary ones if necessary, at some point had the ability to do a survey of the sky looking at the cosmic microwave background, and he says, oh, you know, if it was at any time in this, let's say, a 1 billion year window of the age of the universe now, I think he means, would they see the same pattern of blotches that we see in our pictures of the cosmic microwave background, for example, those taken with the WMAP satellite? In other words, is the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, the same background for all points in the universe? So this is a really good question. It's quite a subtle question. So let's just sort of explain what's involved here. This cosmic microwave background, it's this light that's left over from the Big Bang. It's the sort of fading glow of the Big Bang. And it basically stems from a time, we think about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when the universe was still quite dense and still quite hot, probably typically about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. And up to that point, the universe was basically opaque. It was so dense that the photons couldn't travel freely through the universe. They were absorbed and scattered. And as the universe expands, the density is reduced. And so at this point, 380,000 years after the Big Bang, effectively the universe becomes transparent, and this light's free to travel. Since that time, up to now, we're about 14 billion years after the Big Bang now, the universe has expanded by about a factor of 1,000. So distances between points have increased by about a factor of 1,000. And so these photons that were originally sort of in the sort of red visible part of the spectrum just about have been stretched out to be now in the microwave radio part of the spectrum. And we can look around us in all directions and see photons arriving from distant points in space, which set off at this time, 380,000 years after the Big Bang, and happen to be arriving at us at the instant we're looking at them now. And these are in the microwave radio part of the spectrum, and we can map effectively their intensities or the temperatures all the way around the sky. And when we make that map, we see this sort of pattern of little blotches. It should say that actually the temperature is almost exactly the same everywhere we look of this radiation. So it looks almost identical everywhere. But if you look in great detail, there's tiny fluctuations in the temperature around the sky. And it's those fluctuations that map out the variations in density at the time that light was generated. So around about the time of when this CMB, this cosmic microwave background, was emitted. So the question is, if we're sort of looking out into space and making this map of the CMB as we do, would it look different if we were at a different place in the universe? Now, in fact, the sort of simple answer to that is that it wouldn't look exactly the same for any point as viewed from any point in the universe. And the reason is, I guess you sort of have to imagine us sitting at a point, somewhere. And imagine that around us there's a sphere. So we're sitting at the middle of a sphere. And the surface of that sphere is this surface from which these cosmic microwave background photons set off. The ones that happen to be coming towards us are arriving now at the centre of the sphere. If you can imagine that, all this sort of light from this surface is going off in all directions, but some of it's coming towards us at the middle, and it happens to be arriving now when we make that map. What we see in the cosmic microwave background is we see the variations in density on that particular surface in the universe at the time that it set off. But if you imagine a different point in the universe, not where we are now, but somewhere else, then you'd have a different sphere centered on that point. And so that surface, we call it the last scattering surface, that surface is mapping out a different region of space within the universe, the spherical surface surrounding this other point. So you've got, if you like, two separate spheres. So we'd expect to see the details of these fluctuations be different. Right? You wouldn't expect the same lumpiness in one part as you would in the other part. Having said that, what we do is we measure the details of the properties of this bumpiness, this fluctuation. So we say, for example, how much of it is in very small scale fluctuations, sort of tiny blobs, how much of it is in larger scale fluctuations on the sky, bigger structures on the sky. We call that the power spectrum. It's the spectrum, the variation in the sizes effectively of the features. Now, if we're right about the way the Big Bang works, our understanding of cosmology, then we probably expect that the power spectrum, the way in which the fluctuations are distributed between small scale ones and large scale ones, is the same, no matter where we observe it from in the universe. That's called homogeneity. The universe is homogeneous. We sort of assume that we're not at a special place in the universe, and the universe is basically, on average, the same everywhere. And so in the terms of a CMB map, cosmic microwave background map, we'd expect to see the same power spectrum from every point, even though the details of the actual fluctuations in different directions might be slightly different. The actual physical properties in terms of the power spectrum would be the same. So, and basically because that's governed by the passage of sound waves actually through the early universe, and we'd expect that same physics to work the same everywhere if the universe is homogeneous. Now, you know, there are caveats to that, and there are some interesting things like something called, sort of rather jokingly called, the axis of evil, which are basically alignments in the CMB maps, and they're alignments that one wouldn't expect to be feasible, because of the time which it would take for different regions of space to know about other regions of space. But they're actually only on the very largest angular scales, so they're the largest features on the sky. And the problem with that sort of thing is that we've only got one sky, and so it's only possible for us to have a very small number of these very large features on the sky we see, so the statistics aren't very good. So it may be that those sorts of things are telling us that the universe isn't entirely homogeneous, perhaps, and it may be that as time goes on we'll get more and more information as the universe evolves as well, actually, over perhaps hundreds if not thousands of years. We might actually be able to assess that and work out whether the universe is evolving the way we expect, and is the CMB changing in the way we'd expect with time. Okay, a final question for this month is from Andrew, and he's written in to say, in the book Why Does E Equals MC Squared, your University of Manchester colleagues Brian Cox and Jeff Forshaw wrote that a double pulsar produces gravitational waves that take energy away from their rotational motion and cause them to spiral inward. They also wrote that astronomers at Jodrell Bank and elsewhere were able to measure the rate at which the one known double pulsar spirals inwards to be 7 millimetres a day, which agreed with the prediction of general relativity. Can you explain a bit more about gravitational waves and how this measurement was done? Well, yes. So first of all, let's just again explain a little bit of the facts behind this here. So a pulsar is basically the leftover of a supernova explosion. So when a massive star at the end of its life explodes, it runs out of fuel in the centre of the star. The centre of the star collapses in on itself. The outer parts of the star are blasted off out into space, but the central bit collapses down to become something called a neutron star, a very dense object, maybe only 20 kilometres across, but weighing a little bit more than the sun. And these things have very strong magnetic fields. They produce light of various types, visible light as well, but radio waves mainly is how they were discovered, shooting out from the magnetic poles. And as they spin, typically once a second, but sometimes faster, these beams of light or radio waves coming out of the magnetic poles sweep around the sky, and you see a sort of lighthouse effect. So you see the thing flashing, and hence the name pulsar. So really useful things, interesting in terms of the evolution of stars, but very useful in terms of our understanding of extreme physics, strong magnetic fields, strong gravity, and so on. So how does this work? He talks about gravitational waves, first of all. So this thing, this double pulsar, is actually two pulsars orbiting one another. What happens when you've got two things orbiting one another is a prediction of general relativity, is that you can actually get effectively ripples in space-time produced by the motion of these two masses. And those ripples can carry energy away from that binary system. So were these two things, if this didn't happen, these two things might just orbit forever, roughly, at the same rate. If they're losing energy via gravitational waves, via this so-called gravitational radiation, then the orbit can shrink. They can sort of spiral in together and eventually merge. So in 2003, 2004, there was a group of astronomers led by the groups here at Jodrell Bank and in Australia, and they discovered the first double pulsar, which is two pulsars in one binary system. So first of all, they found the first pulsar using the Parkes radio telescope in Australia. And that was looking for pulsars in a survey that was set up by Andrew Lyne here at Jodrell Bank and Dick Manchester at the Australia National Telescope Facility. And there were other astronomers as well in Australia, in the USA, in India, and in Italy. They found this pulsar called J0737 -30039A. And they found this is quite a fast pulsar, so it's spinning with a period of 23 milliseconds, so spinning very fast. And if you sort of watch the pulses from that pulsar and you time them very accurately when they arrive at Earth, you can actually see that the pulsar must be moving towards and away from us periodically. In other words, it's in a binary system, because basically the observed pulse period changes as the neutron star actually moves closer to us or farther away from us in the other half of the orbit. And it's because you imagine a pulse setting off, and then before the next pulse is set off, the pulsar's actually moved a little bit closer, and so you can sort of compress the pulse period on one side and you can expand it on the other side. So this sort of, it's like a sort of Doppler shift effect on the pulses as the pulsar orbits. So you actually see that it's in a binary orbit. And actually it was in an orbit that lasted 2.4 hours. And you can actually look at the details of that orbit by looking at the observations of that pulsar. And it was soon discovered that this was a slightly eccentric orbit. So it wasn't a perfectly circular orbit. It was slightly elliptical. And it turns out that the sort of orientation of that ellipse was gradually rotating. And this is called relativistic precession. And it's something that's been seen for the planet Mercury as well, going around the Sun. And it's a prediction of Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity. So this was found to be happening in this pulsar. It's actually rotating at 17 degrees per year. That's 100,000 times more than the speed at which Mercury's orbit processes. So it's extremely relativistic, which is very useful because it means that it's a very good test of general relativity. So that actually allowed us to start to, you can measure the rate at which it processes. That gives you information about the masses of the two objects. And it turned out that the second unseen object was a similar sort of mass, just over the mass of the Sun, probably a neutron star, because it had to be very small, because you can sort of measure the time at which the orbit takes. You can therefore work out how big the orbit is, and it would basically fit inside the Sun. So you couldn't have a very big star as the companion. So it's probably another neutron star. And we already knew of several other binary systems which comprised one pulsar and one neutron star, the second neutron star not itself being a pulsar. But this one was actually the shortest period pulsar neutron star binary yet discovered, so that was interesting. But it turned out that we wanted to have a look to see whether actually this second star might itself be a pulsar. And sure enough, it turned out it was. It was a bit hard to spot initially, because it turned out that it was only detectable for part of the orbit, and in fact it was eclipsing. So you had to be looking when it was actually producing the pulses. And this was a much longer spin pulsar. It had a period of 2.8 seconds. So it turns out you've now got this incredibly brilliant test of general relativity, because you've got these two very accurate clocks, these two very heavy objects spinning, so they're like really good flywheels, very high moment inertia. So these things are spinning, one very fast, one rather more slowly, a few seconds. And they're actually orbiting one another with a velocity that's about 10% that of the speed of light, in a very strong gravitational field, and that makes it a great test of general relativity. So given that you can now measure the orbital period by looking at these shifts in the pulse periods, you can actually, over a period of time then, you can measure it. Initially it was we can measure it as 2.4 hours. But because the precision you can get with pulsar timing is so huge, we're actually able to show that that orbital period of 2.4 hours is getting smaller by about 1/100th of a millionth of a second each day, 10 to the minus 8 seconds every day. So very gradually. And when you compare that, so that means it's basically getting a shorter and shorter period. So it's taking less time to go round. That means the orbit is shrinking. And so we've actually got an orbit that's about 1 million kilometers across, the separation. And that shrinking corresponds to about 7 millimeters per day in this orbit of maybe 1 million kilometers across. So that's where that comes from. But also the other, turns out, the most critical test of the best test really of general relativity that you can get out of this double pulsar, and there's a number of them, is something called the Shapiro delay. And that's basically caused when, if you imagine the sort of more distant pulsar being almost directly behind the nearer pulsar, you can measure the arrival time of the pulses as they travel past the nearer pulsar, and it turns out they take longer because of the curvature of space-time around the nearer pulsar. And so obviously general relativity predicts what that effect should be. You can measure that effect in the double pulsar, this so-called Shapiro delay in the arrival times of the pulses, and take the ratio of the two. What does Einstein predict in general relativity? What does the double pulsar show? And the ratio turns out to be basically 1, in other words, the same answer, plus or minus 0.0005. So in other words, you're within 0.05% of the so-called correct value, the Einstein prediction, if you like. And that 0.05% is basically just the error bar on the observations. It's the uncertainty in our measurements. So we can actually able to show with those observations that Einstein's general relativity is at least 99.95% correct. So this is really, the double pulse has a truly phenomenal system. We've done a number of interviews on the Jodcast before about it, and I'll link to those in the online notes. Okay, that's it for this month. If you do have any questions, then send them in the usual way via the webpage at www.jodcast.net.